then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's June the 19th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, with one brief exception, I promise I'll stay in the comfort zone this week. It'll be all news commentary and general non-specific stuff that won't make you guys feel too bad about waiting for Godot, frittering your lives away, sitting behind your computers, and waiting for someone else to do it. Now, the top story this week, as you may guess, is the fact that the Northwest Front has finally broken the media blackout, however briefly, and we achieved a bit of public notice, although it wasn't here in the homeland itself, but down in Colorado. Fort Carson, to be specific. Last week, on Wednesday, June the 11th, there was a clandestine National Alliance-style literature distribution of the kind generally known as littering, i.e. a number of Northwest Front leaflets accompanied by a CD of some kind were distributed in barracks and common areas on the Army base itself. Apparently they're actually wrapped in plastic bags in order to keep the rain and snow and whatnot from getting in. The leaflet appears to be locally produced, and no one has sent me an actual copy of it, but the headline read, "Ever wonder if you're fighting on the wrong side?" which I'm sure caught the attention of Army intelligence and the MPs. No idea what the CD was. Hopefully, my introduction to the Northwest Front that I did and put up here as a shortcast some months ago. I ended up doing a brief phone interview with a female reporter for the local television news, KKTV, in Colorado Springs. Jesus, do the media even have any male reporters left anymore? Now, the story was also published by Military.com. The coverage was what one might expect, a brief description of the leaflet followed by all kinds of expression of shock and horror by alleged local white people. Oh, how could such a thing happen here? That kind of moo. Then, of course, came the obligatory comment by a Jewish so-called expert on us. Not the SPLC this time. I guess Morris and Mark are still sulking and ignoring us. But some heeb named Brian Levin at something called the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California University, which is, of course, financed in some way by taxpayers' money. Now, there were some results, too. There was a small but significant uptick in hits to the website from Colorado, since the media did show the website link, however fleetingly. But they gave the party name, and they did state that we advocate the creation of a white homeland in the Pacific Northwest, which is the first time the imperative itself has been mentioned in the media since 2011 with the bionic backpack incident in Spokane and Rachel Maddow's brief little hissy fit before she was told to shut up by whoever runs her. So far, the MPs don't appear to have located or identified the individuals responsible for the leaflet distribution, although since it took place on the post itself, there's a good chance that it may be one or more active duty soldiers. Now, for the record, I myself have absolutely no idea who did this, but I dig it. Now, this is how things are supposed to work. You guys aren't supposed to log on to the internet every morning or turn on CNN and wonder, "Hey, I wonder what Harold is cooking up today." I am the one who should be logging on to the news sites every morning and saying to myself, "Hey, I wonder what the boys got up to last night." When things start happening that way, then we'll know we're on the right track. Second big event of the week, the end of one of America's recent imperial adventures. Iraq is now in the process of falling apart. At first, I thought Baghdad might be going the way of Saigon, but that now seems a bit premature. The Shiites in Baghdad and in the south seem to be getting their act together with the help of Iranian money and supplies and troops. Oh, it may yet happen. Baghdad may indeed fall to the Sunni rebel army, which is what ISIS is. It's not so-called terrorists, nor are most of them quote-unquote Al-Qaeda inspired, although some of them might be. Personally, I question whether Al-Qaeda even exists anymore, if indeed it ever did. What these guys in the pickup trucks waving the AK-47s are is Sunni Muslim Iraqis, a lot of them political and military veterans from the Saddam days, who are making their move to take their country back from the U.S.-backed puppet Nouri al-Maliki. Just like the Taliban is going to make a move on Mohammad Karzai as soon as the U.S. troops leave. The Sunnis were top dogs under Saddam. Then, when the Americans came, it was the Shiites' turn, and now the two of them are going to battle it out. Essentially, in order to create a quote-unquote stable Iraqi government, read pliable and obedient puppet regime, the sharper Americans from back in Jugger's day, like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, eventually gave up trying to turn Baghdad into the New York City of the Middle East with a Starbucks and a Fern Bar on every corner, like that was ever going to happen. And they reversed the religious pecking order in Iraq and put the Shiites on top under Maliki. The Democrats then took over in 2009 and pulled out, leaving Maliki loaded to the gills with all kinds of American military equipment, much of which has now either been captured by the rebels or by Shiite militias like the Mahdi Army, or maybe even the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, who are supposed to be on the ground in Iraq even though no one is actually admitting the fact. There is a possibility that for a brief period, the U.S. military and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard are going to find themselves fighting on the same side, and even coordinating airstrikes against a common enemy. I know war produces some strange turnips, but that's about as weird as it gets. Oh, and our man-child president has just sent 275 hapless soldiers to guard the huge green zone in the U.S. Embassy that was supposed to be the center of the New World Order's Middle Eastern Empire. Now, you know that huge fortified complex complete with Starbucks, Burger King, and Pizza Hut? Then Barry took over and fled the country, and it's been a kind of a ghost town for years with only about one-tenth the staff it was supposed to hold, and many of those are fleeing now. Some of them are also being moved to other, less secure places around the country. Ah, yes, that brilliant expertise that the Hillary Clinton State Department displayed in Benghazi seems to be coming to the fore again. If I were one of those 275 soldiers, I'd be sweating. Looks like they may be getting a ringside seat for a good old-fashioned siege. That drip, drip, drip you hear is the egg dripping off Barack Hussein Obama and Hillary Clinton's faces. Be interesting to see if the media can get it all scrubbed away by 2016.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss a book that was a request and turned out to be very interesting. It's by John Glad and it's called Jewish Eugenics. Now, when John Glad first decided to study eugenics, he turned to some in academia for advice and information, and at that point he was looked upon with great suspicion. And so he decided to look into the topic for himself. He was particularly interested in how eugenics became such a vilified subject. Now, as you might imagine, the topic of eugenics is very unpopular today. But he points out in this book that eugenics did not simply disappear after 1945. In fact, the topic of eugenics was rather popular even into the 60s. So he wants to know how eugenics became so vilified, since the idea of producing healthy babies is about as uncontroversial a view as anyone could have. Now, in this book, he talks about the relationship of the Holocaust Memorial Movement to eugenics, and about how there really wasn't that much support for Zionism, even into the late 40s and beyond. But in 1967, Israel won the Six-Day War, and that was a great boost for Israel and the idea of Zionism. At this point, the Jews, or particularly those in this Holocaust memorial movement, decided to reshape the left to their own needs, because prior to this, the political left was not necessarily pro-Zionist. In many cases, it was not. But it was realized that if the Holocaust was made popular and common as a subject, and if the topic of eugenics, for example, could be interwoven into the Holocaust, then really many nations would be really guilted into the support of Israel. And so this Holocaust memorial movement supported a lot of things such as documentaries and books and movies that all drove home the point that eugenics was connected to the National Socialist agenda and therefore was connected to the Holocaust. Now, this author wants to point out that although the Reich was somewhat concerned with eugenics, many nations at that time were also concerned with eugenics, simply because in that era, eugenics was very much in vogue. It was in vogue because at that point, we were starting to learn more about science and genetics. And because of that, there was an interest in how eugenics might be used to really bolster the future for everyone, to make a better future. Actually, there were a lot of Jewish people who were interested in the topic of eugenics. And in fact, in Israel, for example, particularly among the Ashkenazi Jews, because they have so many genetic issues and problems and potential birth defects, they really do a lot of screening in Israel, and they really have no compunction about this. And he talks about Judaism, and he says Judaism really is a religion very much of independent thought. And he says that Christianity is not really as much like Judaism as people believe. He says that Christianity really is much more like Islam in the sense that it is very messianic. Now, one of the things that John Glad is very worried about is he's very worried about science, but also other academic topics such as governance, the history, for example, of Europe, German history, history of the Reich. All of these important topics are really being given short shrift because they're all being reduced to the topic of Holocaust. The author points out various other authors, such as Sander Gilman, who writes about German culture and has framed everything in German culture in terms of Holocaust. The author also talks about books such as The Mismeasure of Man and also a book called Not in Our Genes. And he feels that these books were really written from a place of emotion and they've misled the public about eugenics, which he thinks could be very beneficial. He thinks that it's potentially dangerous that people are being given such wrong information. The author tends to believe in genetic determinism and feels that Sociobiology by Wilson was a very informative science book. And the author talks about the benefits of discriminating altruism, which is used in the Jewish community to great success. This author feels that eugenics is very much, at the end of the day, a common sense view, and he fears that there are individuals who have abandoned this common sense because of emotionalism fostered by the Holocaust Memorial Movement. This author is no denier of the Holocaust. In fact, this author says that an emotional response to the Holocaust is very much understandable, but he's concerned about how Holocaust industry and this idea of Holocaust has been weaponized to influence individuals in an undue fashion. And, for example, he talks about the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which was put out just as many Jews were becoming more and more concerned with intermarriage. So he sees a certain manipulation and or hypocrisy going on that he wants to point out. Now, he points out that it is difficult to define Judaism because the Jews are really more a breeding collective than an altruistic societal collective than they are a race per se, so he does point that out. He talks about how the eugenics movement, depending on who you want to look at and study in eugenics, there are many different goals or potential goals that eugenicists have had, and therefore it's not always It's like in Gattaca, where everyone orders something different. So this idea of eugenics is not necessarily towards only one goal of, say, the kind of things you might attribute to the Third Reich, for example. There's more to eugenics than that. And he talks about how Judaism really fosters independent thought. And in Judaism, they see themselves as potential partners to divinity. And so, therefore, Jewish people see eugenics as a force that can be used for good. And he also says that although there were some Jews that fostered immigration or indirectly fostered it because of all this guilt revolving around the Holocaust, he says that today many Jews are very alarmed about all of this third world immigration into areas where whites live, because in these areas there are also some Jews living there, and they're really afraid of all these Islamicists who are moving into the first world and other minority groups, or groups that we used to call minorities, but really they're not minorities anymore in many places. They've become majorities, about how they may be unsympathetic to Jews. And so this author is quite concerned about all of these topics. However, he does say that in Israel, they have never abandoned the potential eugenics, and they're willing to use it for themselves as they need it. And they really do need it, especially in Ashkenazi communities. So I actually found this to be a very interesting book. I would recommend it. And another book that I would like to read is a book by Norman Finkelstein. This is a book called The Holocaust Industry. Now, Finkelstein's parents were survivors, but even so, Finkelstein apparently is concerned about how the idea of Holocaust is used in manipulative ways. And there's a lot of notes at the end of the book. I would say that some of these notes become rather redundant and long-winded, but they're interesting to read through in any case. And at one point, the statement is even made that Darwinists should become revisionists, if only because a less emotive view of the Holocaust would be helpful to promote genetic determinism, only because there would be less guilt in taking a more deterministic point of view. Now, the author leaves us with some very important questions. The author wants to know what democracy is if most are indifferent to important matters such as survival. What is free will if we don't decide what we want? What is God or religion in today's world when we realize or we understand science so much better than we used to? The author wants to know where we go from here, and the author is concerned that right now there are so many things in the world that are being ruled by emotion that even though this might seem to be very nice because everyone is trying to be in perhaps a loving frame of mind, the author reminds us that really evolution is, in a sense, at stake, or at least the betterment of the species. And so the author is very concerned about these things and is therefore writing this book. Again, eugenics is a complex topic, and again, there can be different goals to eugenics. I mean, some people want purity, some people want hybrids. It's a topic that is not necessarily exclusively racial. In a way, it's a more general topic than that. So it should be viewed in that light. And it should also be understood that the pulling away from eugenics is just as political as any other viewpoint. In fact, the author even points out that at one point, Boaz was an eugenicist that changed his tune later on. And that's really quite remarkable because, of course, the later Boaz was anything but an eugenicist. My view, and I would assume the author's view, is that evidence should be studied and should be studied in an objective manner, whether evidence for determinism or environmental causes. So thank you for listening, and I hope you come away from this book, if you do decide to read it, with a more balanced and nuanced view of eugenics.
Hi, this is Harold again, and I just played this episode back prior to uploading it to the site, and I came across a section of about 6 or 7 minutes in this first segment that, in my considered opinion, it would not be politic for me to broadcast at this time. In fact, I received a note just this morning which reminded me that we are under periodic surveillance. And after thinking about this one section in here, I think it just wouldn't be a good idea. So I have removed about 6 or 7 minutes from the podcast here. So I'm kind of stepping to find a replacement for that section. And what I think I will do is have a book review of my own. I've actually dug out one of my books. This is from a volume called Broken by Richard Gid Powers, and it's about the FBI and the history of the FBI. I think, you know, one of the things I've often considered for this show is setting up a kind of regular feature called Who Guards the Guardians or something like that, and just detailing some of the inner workings of these people who are watching us and listening to us and wiretapping us and archiving our emails and pretending to be so superior and taking upon themselves the moral authority to send people to prison for life and that sort of thing. Just who are these people? How do they live? How do they work? How do they operate? What entitles them to that incredible power and authority? Anyway, I'm actually just going to read a book here, which is something I normally don't do. This deals with the assumption of office of a former FBI director named William Sessions in November of 1987. Top bureau officials desperately wanted the new director to succeed, but from the beginning they noticed a strange disconnect between Sessions and his job. He seemed to see the position as largely ceremonial. He accepted nearly every invitation to speak and continuously junketed around the country, particularly back to Texas, to attend meetings which seemed trivial to his executives. They thought it looked amateurish for Sessions always to be wearing his gold FBI badge on his shirt, something real agents rarely did. He tried to ingratiate himself by displaying his ignorance about the Bureau. He liked to say how surprised he had been to learn that the Bureau did counter-espionage. This was perhaps an attempt to connect with his audiences, except that it would have been a remarkably uninformed American who never even heard that the FBI sometimes chased spies. And Americans do expect their FBI directors to know a little bit about their job. Another problem was Sessions' wife. Some agents and officials thought she acted, in effect, as co-director of the Bureau. Alice Sessions responded that top officials were simply misogynistic, describing their attitude as, "We aren't used to having a wife involved in the FBI, and we don't intend to." Obviously, this was in the days before the Clintons and the Obamas came along. She further antagonized the agents by letting it drop that she thought the trouble was that none of the other directors had wives, or at least healthy wives. Agents who served under Clarence Kelly resented this because they sympathized with him as he nursed his dying wife in Kansas City. William Webster's wife was highly regarded by the Bureau, and she too had died while he was director. Bureau officials were convinced that Sessions... blah, 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 blah. Okay, basically, this goes on here to detail how this woman was sticking her nose in the Bureau of Business. Shortly after Sessions took over, Attorney General William P. Barr had to rebuke him for taking his wife on FBI planes to visit family and friends, a violation of government regulations. Agents complained that Alice Sessions had security guards park her car under the Hoover headquarters building when she went shopping. She created the appearance of trying to steer an expensive security contract for their house to Dan Munford, husband of Sarah Munford, Sessions' personal assistant. The Bureau refused to award the contract, citing the high cost, lack of competitive bidding, and Dan Munford's close relationship with the director's assistant. Well, that was in the 1980s. I imagine today there would probably be no problem. Mrs. Sessions demanded a special pass at headquarters that allowed her to bring in visitors without signing them in, and then often forgot the pass and demanded to be waved in with her friends. Well, I've been a security guard on door duty. That kind of crap just really drives you around the twist. The impression that Sessions was dominated by the women in his life was reinforced by the activities of Sarah Munford, the personal assistant he brought with him from Texas. According to agents that journalist Ronald Kessler interviewed, Munford did not seem up to her responsibilities and blamed her mistakes on the agents in Sessions' personal detail. Like Alice Sessions, she too received special treatment, sometimes in trivial ways that were nevertheless hot buttons to agents. She continued to register her car in Texas after she had moved to Virginia, which might seem like a small matter, but re-registering was an inconvenient and inexpensive obligation for agents when they relocated. I always thought it was state law you had to re-register your vehicle when you changed addresses interstate for more than 30 days. It was one of the many inconveniences endured by the oft-transferred agents who resented it when Sessions exempted his assistant from the regulation. She also tried to use her FBI credentials to get out of a traffic ticket in Texas without being disciplined by Sessions, even though the matter was serious enough later to get her fired. She developed a reputation for blaming agents around her when she made mistakes. Well, I mean, that's a typical feminist characteristic, not restricted to the FBI. Soon, almost no one at the Bureau would deal with her, which made it almost impossible for her to get anything done for Sessions. Okay, the point I'm trying to make here is that these people who claim this moral superiority to the rest of us, to the point where they have the right to put the rest of us in prison for life, including fabricating evidence if they so choose, do in fact have feet of clay. They live lives of petty office intrigue and bullshit just like we do. Now, this was back in the 1980s under Republicans, bear in mind, and I've got no brief for Republicans, but what we see here basically is the usual petty corruption which has always been prevalent in the American system. The murder, the torture, the spying, the archiving of emails, the trampling on the Constitution, the shooting a guy in his apartment in Florida 6 times in the front and once in the back of the head and then walking away from it, all that came later under the Democrats. Anyway, speaking of Africa, here's Warren Zevon.
Ronan was a warrior from the land of the midnight sun, with a Thompson gun for hire, fighting to be done. The deal was made in Denmark on a dark and stormy day, so he set out for Biafra to join the bloody fray. Through 66 and 7 they fought the Congo War, with their fingers on their triggers, knee deep in gore. Days and nights they suit to their knees. They kill to earn their living and to help out the Congolese. Roland the Thompson Gunner. Roland the Thompson Gunner. His comrades fought beside him. Thompson gunners, Roland was the best. So the CIA decided they wanted Roland dead. That son of a bitch Van Owen blew off Roland's head. Body stalking through the night in the muzzle flash of Roland's Thompson gun. In the muzzle flash of Roland's Thompson gun. Roland searched the continent for the man who'd done him in. He found him in Mombasa, in a ballroom drinking gin. Roland aimed his Thompson gun, he didn't say a word. But he blew Van Owen's body from there to Johannesburg. Roland the headless Thompson gunner. Roland the headless Thompson gunner. Thompson gunner, talking about the man. Roland the headless Thompson gunner. The eternal Thompson gunner, still wandering through the night. Now it's 10 years later, but it still keeps up the fight. In Ireland, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Berkeley.
Good afternoon, comrades. I ran across a blog post the other day that really caught my attention and says some things we all know, but very rarely articulate in this way. You can find the original post at thegeneralreport.wordpress.com. It's entitled, "Whites Shouldn't Be Forced to Live Among Non-Whites." Although I probably would have given it the title, "We Can Stop Living Like This Anytime You Like." It goes something like this. I am an individual human being. I am also a white human being. I was born the same way as all other human beings were born. No other human being has any more rights than I have. As long as I don't harm others, no other human being has the right to tell me how to live, who to associate with, what to think, what to believe, what I can and cannot read or do, or what I can or cannot say. They are not superior in rights to me. This is what it means to be a free human being. Anything less than this is not freedom. It is oppression, tyranny, and slavery. That is the world we live in today. It is obscene that white people have to put up with non-white crime and social problems. And even more, it is absurd that all the races of the human species are lumped together as though they are all the same. They are not all the same. They look different externally. They have different DNA codes internally. They are different peoples. The human races are groups within the human species that are separate and distinct. We should not be forced to blend together, but should be allowed to evolve as we determine is best for each of us, individually, and as groups of racially alike peoples. Blending all human races together will not improve the species, rather it will force it down to the lowest common denominator, and we all know what that is. Racial integration, racial diversity, and multiculturalism all have failed. All cultures are not equal, and anyone with half a brain knows this. Living with these social experiments only brings non-white crime, non-white social problems, and miscegenation to once safe and, yes, pure white communities. And whites are not only victimized physically by these failed social experiments, we are also victimized financially by being made to pay for services and benefits for people unlike and unfit to live among us. In order to avoid being labeled racist, whites are expected to just accept being made into second-class citizens and to give up college seats, job opportunities, and promotions to less qualified non-whites. We are expected to allow our schools to be dumbed down to their level and to bend over backward to understand and be sensitive to the needs of peoples who are radically different from us. This is stupid! Whites shouldn't have to waste 1 second of our time or burn 1 calorie in such efforts. There is no profit in this for us. Non-whites are not our kind. They are not our people. We owe them nothing other than to leave them alone to their own separate destinies. The way it stands now, whites must pay for the welfare, medical care, housing, and so much more for non-whites who don't contribute in any way to society, and we must hire more police and pay for them to keep non-whites from attacking and murdering us since we have been forced to accept them into our communities. The ant and the grasshopper fable comes to mind, but tenfold, as we, the industrious white ants, have been forced to accept the non-white grasshoppers into our ant communities as equals. The result is harmful to us. Even if some groups of non-whites do not pose a direct threat, they are still not our kind and do not belong in our world. Whites should only have to put up with the crime and social problems of our own people. We as white individuals have a natural right, just by virtue of having been born, to choose to mix or not to mix with any other human being as we alone decide is in our best interest. And this right that we have as white individuals extends to those who are most like us, other whites. Yes, whites are different from other kinds of human beings just as they are different from us. There is not a one-size-fits-all human being. But then those of you who are listening to this already know that. Even the least intelligent of whites acknowledges that human beings come in different flavors. After all, even they have eyes to see and ears to hear. So they're pretty much forced to admit there are external differences. At some point, though, common sense falls apart, because many of them eventually try to deny that there are internal differences to go along with the external ones. Some even go so far as to try to deny the significance of the differences, whether internal or external, including foolishly trying to deny that violent crime and social dysfunction levels are color-coded. Some suffer greatly from cognitive dissonance because of jumping through crazy hoops trying to reconcile high levels of violent crime among blacks with their false belief that blacks are the same as whites, except for different paint jobs, of course. One could almost imagine some of them having smoke coming from their ears as their minds chant, "Will not compute! Will not compute!" as they try to reconcile the facts of the real world with their ingrained false views. Kind of like robots in a cheap science fiction movie. Let's be very clear about this. Non-whites are not white, and we all know this. They look different because they are different. And this is true no matter what some dim-witted politician or elite tries to tell us or force upon us. Whites are a white people inside and out. We are no one's slaves. We have the right to be free from non-white violent crime, non-white social problems, and actually free from non-whites altogether. Let them have their ways. We'll have ours. don't try to lump us together under some artificial national label. The most authentic label that we have is the one we were born with and wear proudly every day of our lives. White people. We are our genes, and our genes are us. No one has the right to force us to sacrifice our safety, our pursuit of happiness, or our very existence in order to please people unlike us. We have no obligation to please them at all. We also have no obligation to support them, take a back seat so they can have the front seat, or give up our dreams of college and better jobs because they are admitted or promoted based on their mud-colored skins. We have no obligation to sacrifice ourselves, our children, our jobs, or our future, and no one can make a case that we do. We have a right to be and to be more, and we need to assert these rights in every way, big and small, or we're going to continue to be victimized and picked off one by one. Non-whites are not our responsibility. We owe them absolutely nothing. They are not our kind. In fact, they are a burden to us, a burden we have no obligation to carry. We have enough burdens of our own. Whites have a right to self-identification, self-determination, and self-destiny. If we're honest with ourselves, we cannot continue to live in a society that includes those who are not like us. They do not and cannot fit into our society, and we do not, nor would we want to, fit in theirs. We know who we are, and if we're honest with ourselves, we want to stay with our own kind. We can do something about this anytime you choose. We don't have to live in a society that includes non-whites. But if we're going to create that reality, we have to make that happen. And it has to happen on our terms. We already have all we need inside of us. All it takes is that first step. The choice is yours. Hail victory, comrades!
Guys, can you do me a favor? Can you listen carefully to this podcast and see if you hear anything funny about the sound? Now, I'm playing this back here, and I'm getting something that happens occasionally, which is a kind of an echo or reverb that makes it sound like I'm talking down a rain barrel. I don't know if that's just my computer speakers going wonky, or whether it's something screwy in my WavePad or some of the other files that I'm editing. Right, some months ago, I read an email on here from a kid in California named Noah, who was asking my advice as to whether or not he should join the United States military. I advised him against it if it could be at all avoided, but if he absolutely had to go for the Air Force or the Coast Guard. Well, what he did was he went into the Job Corps, and I got another email from him this week. Hello, HAC. I have contacted you once again to inform you that I will be leaving for the Job Corps this coming week. My mother has already begun the process of packing up my room, and I overheard various conversations from my family in near joy over the prospect of turning my room into a new guest room. Shows you how great my relationship with my family has become. But on the bright side, I will finally be leaving the house. I got a job in the timber sector up in Tahoe for the coming year and intend to use all of the job training that I learn to further myself economically so that when I do head up northwest next year, I will be ready. I am writing to inform you that while working, I will not have internet, so I guess I won't be listening to much RFN in the coming months, but I already have stored up safely in my mind all the necessary racial education that I've received over the past 3 or 4 years. I will do what I can to preach to the fellow redneck working class white boys on the job site the idea of the Northwest Republic. I've already given out the brigade to a few of my friends, and they've enjoyed it and liked the idea of white secession. It's pretty easy for me to explain racial stuff to guys my age, so I see no reason why it would be any more difficult in the future. Anyway, HAC, I want to thank you for all you've done for our people. And I promise, as a white man of the upcoming generation, that we will do what past generations of white Americans have failed to do. For such a long time, I wondered why I was born in this awful time and place. I wished I could just zap back to Germany, 1936, or South Africa under apartheid, or America in the 1920s, or some time in our past when the white man was free to be all that he could be. But then I realized why I was born in this time and place, and it was because I was chosen to be part of the winning generation, the generation that finally does what needs to be done to achieve the 14 words. Now that's why I've become grateful that I was born in this time and place, because I know that we will win. It's like what Commander George Lincoln Rockwell always said about the meaning of life, to struggle for what you believe in and to enjoy the struggle as much as possible. You know the commander was right about that too, but this week I'll be busy packing up and saying goodbye to all my friends and my beautiful girlfriend. But this isn't a sad occasion for me. It's time, I feel, for me to quit being a white boy and to become a white man. Thank you, HAC. I can't wait to meet you and the others next summer. Seriously, Noah. Okay, the group Rapus 8 is definitely an acquired taste, and I'm probably going to leave it alone after this one final epic piece of high culture, which is entitled Nude Black Potty Panda Show Jump Defense. No, I'm not making this up. That's what it's called.
Black Panthers love cracker, baby, cracker, baby. Black Panthers love cracker, baby, head. Grab up the cracker, bust up the head. Eat cracker brains for the cracker, baby, dead. Red neck, red bone, man in the bed. One turn over and the other one said, you just cracker, that's what I said. That's why you owe me, cause your neck's so red. Black Panthers love barbecue cracker. Yum, yum, eat them up, cracker, baby, stew. Black Panthers down in the hood, get them some crackers and cook them up good. Put on skillet, slip on lid, cook a little cracker with Charmin bread. Mammy little panda loves Charmin, Charmin. Mammy black panda loves Charmin bread. Slip in the kitchen, crack a hose dead, cook up the whole cake, Charmin bread. Black Panthers love cracker, whole screaming mode. Black Panthers love a cracker, whole dead. It's us cracker, bust up the head, eat out the brains for the cracker, whole dead. It's us cracker, that's what we do, cook us cracker, make cracker heads too. Mammy little panda love Charmin, Charmin. Mammy black panda love Charmin bread. The house don't matter, ain't got no sense. Black panther party shoot up the fence. Mammy little panda love Charmin, Charmin. Mammy black panda love Charmin bread. Mammy little panda love Charmin, Charmin. Mammy black panda love Charmin bread.
I've been hearing Mr. Covington speak about the white character issue for some time. I was wanting a definition of what he meant, and I found a list of things I think address this issue. White folk virtues. Courage. My fear does not keep me from defending my folk, my family, or myself. I conquer my fear. Discipline. I control my mind, will, and emotions. I do, of my own accord, what needs to be done. Fidelity. I keep the vows I make, especially those to folk, family, and self. Honor. I keep pure the name and honor of my folk, family, and self. Hospitality. For folk and family, I willingly share my food, hearth, and shelter. Industriousness. I perform my tasks with joy and honor, holding nothing back. Perseverance, I continue until I've met my obligations and my goals. Self-reliance, I support my folk, my family, and myself. I depend only on myself. I strengthen the independence of the folk and family. Truth, I search for and embrace the truth. When speaking the truth may harm my folk or family, I keep silent. Live with courage and honor, comrades.
Right, I promised you guys I would stay in the comfort zone for this show, so I'll go on with some more of the standard pablum of the right wing. News commentary. Now, that's where the right wing tells you how bad things are. Oh, look what they're doing to us now. Isn't it all so horrible? Send us money so we can keep on telling you how bad things are. Okay, first off, I heard this morning that the dictatorship's patent office has revoked the trademark of the Washington Redskins football team because the name is quote-unquote offensive to Native Americans. Odd. I don't find it particularly offensive, and I always thought I was a Native American, seeing as how I was born in America. Oh, I forget, I'm the wrong color. What this is, of course, is the beginning of a new policy on the part of the regime of confiscating private property due to considerations of political correctness. Now, this has happened before, of course, but mostly through the abuse of civil litigation in order to do an end run around the First Amendment and accomplish political objectives which are forbidden by the Constitution. Or in this case, as a club to force people to behave in a politically correct manner. The worst example of this was what was done to Matt Hale before his arrest under the Patriot Act for the crime of typing a single sentence in an AOL instant chat room. In light of what happened to him later, we tend to forget what went on before that. Now, I suspect pretty much all of you out there know what I think about Benny Klassen and his cult, but I have never denied his right to write and publish his work, such as it was. But a federal judge in Chicago ordered all stocks of the Klassen books tracked down and burned by the U.S. Marshals. Now, I might add that this woman failed to suppress the Klassen books, for better or worse. She reckoned without a little something called the Internet. It is not actually possible for a court of law or anybody wearing a black robe to suppress a book, but I suppose they'll keep on trying. And the Washington Redskins are always going to be the Washington Redskins in people's minds, no matter what a deranged third world tyrant decrees through his corrupt courts and bureaucracy. Next up, the electoral defeat of the Republican Jew Eric Cantor in Virginia. Basically, Cantor slipped up. He thought he didn't have to worry about a challenge from some little unknown Tea Party guy who was only able to raise $200,000, which in the American electoral system is chicken feed. And so he didn't bother to get the usual vote fraud machine up and running and in place. Through one of the flukes, which the system is still capable of producing from time to time, the voice of normal people was actually heard. And normal people did not want any more of Eric Cantor. He went down, and the ghost of Nelson Rockefeller is no doubt weeping and rattling the chains he forged in life as he wanders in hell weighed down by his cash boxes. Gee, I'm devastated. No more elegant little kike in a $2,000 suit swishing through the Capitol corridors, whispering sweet nothings into state-controlled media ears about how the big sellout on immigration is coming in August. John Boehner has lost his primary accomplice in the destruction of the country and his own party. I'm just grief-stricken. Maybe the rest of the spineless leeches in the Boehner crew will be so scared shitless that they'll back off from betraying their country and constituents and turning America into a one-party third-world totalitarian state by legalizing 30 million new Democrats. Maybe, but don't count on it. And finally, there is the Brown Children's Crusade now overwhelming our southern border so that certain towns in Texas and Arizona now resemble the Camp of the Saints. And Border Patrol agents are changing diapers and cooking up baby formula. Does anyone really believe that Obama and his liberal Democrat handlers are not behind this? This little stunt has been on the cards ever since Obama instituted the DREAM Act by imperial decree 2 years ago, after Congress had already rejected it twice. It was arguably the most clearly unconstitutional act he has committed while in office, and since nothing was done about it, this current mudflow became inevitable. Finally, you may remember Brandon Raub, a decorated Marine who was forcefully confined to a mental institution about 18 months ago for making Facebook posts that said unkind things about the One. I suppose in view of what's happening right now to Bill White, he's fortunate that that's all that happened and he was eventually released. He is now suing the federal government for the apparent civil rights violation. Lots of luck with that, Brandon. In 2012, Raub was arrested for posting, quote-unquote, controversial song lyrics, conspiracy theories related to 9/11, and talk of upcoming revolution. He was arrested without a warrant and taken by force to a cackle box, where he was, quote-unquote, treated for something called oppositional defiance disorder, a term that the dictatorship now uses to brand anybody who disagrees with the way they're running things as being insane. I guess that's what we've all got, huh? Oppositional defiance disorder. I like the sound of that. I wonder what they called it in the Soviet Union when dissidents were also confined in gulag prisons disguised as hospitals. Now, this is not an isolated incident, however. Raub was detained as part of a DHS directive called Operation Vigilant Eagle, a program aimed at scrutinizing the behavior of veterans for anything nonconformist as a means of weeding out dissent. The program claims to be trying to help veterans who are quote-unquote disgruntled, disillusioned, or suffering from the psychological effects of war. But even some liberal critics have noted that the criteria are overly broad and seem to target right-wing thought as a dangerous behavior worthy of institutionalization, where veterans can become re-educated. And if that doesn't work, maybe a total frontal lobotomy will do the trick. Now, according to the dictatorship's new psychobabble handbooks, oppositional defiance disorder denotes that the person exhibits symptoms such as the questioning of authority, the refusal to follow directions, stubbornness, the unwillingness to go along with the crowd, and the practice of disobeying or ignoring orders. People can also receive such a label if they are considered freethinkers, nonconformists, or individuals who are suspicious of large centralized government. That's a quote, apparently a direct quote from the government directive, although the guy who sent this to me didn't send me a copy of that. So I guess that since the dictatorship now defines anyone who opposes the one as insane, Radio Free Northwest needs a new theme song now.
Remember when you ran away and I got on my knees and begged you not to leave because I go berserk? Well, you left me anyhow, and then the days got worse and worse, and now you see I've gone completely out of my mind. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time. And I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. You thought it was a joke, and so you laughed. You laughed when I had said that losing you would make me flip my lid. Right? You know you laughed. I heard you laugh. You laughed, you laughed, and laughed, and then you left. But now you know I'm utterly mad. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. I cooked your food. I cleaned your house. And this is how you pay me back for all my kind, unselfish, loving deeds. Huh? Well, you just wait. They'll find you yet. And when they do, they'll put you in the ASPCA, you mangy mutt. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time. And I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats. And they're coming to take me away.
I'm sorry, I will just use any excuse to play that. Okay, I'm going to close with a few comments on something that I hope will save me a lot of emailing and expostulation over the next few weeks. I won't get too specific about what's going on. Those of you who are on the Northwest Revolution email list will know. Now, let me just speak in general terms here. About once per show, I come on like Grandpa Simpson, and I remind you guys that I have 42 years of experience doing this mess, and I've only been arrested 3 times, beaten once, and never spent a night in a jail cell. Now, that may yet change, of course. It seems like the older someone gets, the more anxious the FBI becomes to make sure that you die in prison. They evidently don't like the idea of wicked white racist codgers escaping them by dying of natural causes like Rick Cooper and Demi Johnson did. It pisses them off. It sets a bad example for the rest of us, I guess. Anyway, the fact is that Grandpa Simpson or not, I probably do have more time in grade than anybody else who remains active. Unless you want to count a few other old-timers like Willis Cardo, Ed Fields, Louis Beam, and David Duke. I'm certainly the one who is the most willing to share his experience with you. But as I've said before, one of the hardest lessons one learns when one grows older is that you have to play the cards you're dealt. The world is the way it is. You guys are the way you are, and you are that way because your world has made you, and I've had to drag myself kicking and screaming to the awareness that this 42 years of experience, which I so desperately want to share with you, to keep you from making the same mistakes I and countless others have made, well, it seems to be largely unteachable. Most of it will probably die with me, and you guys will need many years to recover some approximation of the knowledge and the skill set and the tactical and strategic sense that I have developed down through the years, especially my historical and observational knowledge of what will work if we can ever find the courage to do it, and what will never work no matter how often we do it. You might say that guys like me and Louis Beam and a few others, we're the last of the older generation. We're the last of the summer wine, as they say in Great Britain. It seems to take us entire lifetimes to learn wisdom. Of the letters and emails I get from newly awakened and enthusiastic white boys, I'd say that over half of them are from men who are over 50 years of age. Somehow or other, we have to start inducing this wisdom-gaining epiphany in young white men in their 20s. But that's another story. I'm actually hopeful that Obama and the Democrats will largely do that for us. Now, the classic definition of stupidity is to keep on doing the same thing over and over again, and yet each time expecting a different result. Now, that seems to be the curse that the gods have laid on us as a punishment for our cowardice, our laziness, and our narcissism. Now, how long will we keep on doing the same thing over and over again? I don't know. I've come to accept that everybody has to go through my learning curve on their own, and that is why when someone comes to me and they want to try something that is not necessarily wrong as such, just proven completely ineffective over the past century. When they do that, I don't jump and shout and scream and curse at them or try to exorcise them with bell, book, and candle. I couldn't do that anyway. I've said before, it's not like I'm really some kind of fearless leader. I can't give orders to anybody. I can only make suggestions and offer advice, most of which is ignored. So when I see someone doing something which I know is going to produce exactly nothing in the way of results for the Northwest Republic, I no longer jump and shout. I accept that everyone has to go through my learning curve for themselves, and that they simply will not be told. Unless it is something that is outright dangerous or truly bird-brain stupid to the point of being counterproductive, I'm even willing to offer a certain degree of public acknowledgement and facilitation. I do this so that the person can proceed along his or her learning curve, and also, I admit, to try and keep some of the goat dancing down. So, anybody who's got the gotta do something itch, and you decide to do something that was done by thousands of people 50 years ago, where you will be lucky to get 5 or 6 today, then that's what you want to do. Hey, knock yourself out. I shall not say you nay. Onward and upward. Better living through chemistry. Excelsior! I have told you at great length how I think this thing ought to be done. We have an entire party manual which explains how it should be done, and which has so far been almost completely ignored. Until such time as I am given money and warm bodies to build on those ideas, we're just killing time. And if some of you want to waste some of your own time on doing things that have been proven for generations to be completely ineffective, then it's your time to waste. Well, actually, no, it isn't. It's history's time you're wasting, and the supply of that is limited, but that's another concept I don't seem to be able to convey with any great success. Well, Grandpa Simpson's time is up. Godot still hasn't arrived, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.